You know, Brad, we've gone back and forth about whether or not we should do spoiler alerts for our episodes, but I think this episode needs an alert of some other kind.
So not a spoiler. So what do you mean?
Well, okay. Do you remember when you were a kid back in the day and you had just like an hour before you were going to go to bed and there was your TV show was going to be on and you were so excited and you're sitting there waiting for your TV show to start. You're waiting for Alice or Donnie and Marie. Well, maybe not Donnie and Marie, but you're sitting there waiting for it. And suddenly the episode doesn't start. There's a black screen that comes up and then an ominous voice says, "Due to the mature subject matter of this episode, viewer discretion is advised."
And usually those were very special episodes.
Very special episodes. Well, I think this episode of Going Hollywood needs that kind of very special episode advisor.
There's some touchy stuff in here.
There is. And the movie that we're going to talk about, Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood, based on Scotty Bauer's book, Full Service, does have some mature subject matter, and it might have some things which people find triggering or, you know, it's for mature audiences, I guess I want to say.
And I think we can say there's sexual abuse and things of that nature.
Yes, things that people might find disturbing. So just keep that in mind, listener. We're giving you a listener discretion advised warning, but it's a fun episode. So
if that bothers you, you have our permission to skip this week.
I don't want them to skip it. They should listen to it.
All right.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. Just brace yourself.
So just, you've been advised. You've been advised. So we hope you enjoy this episode on Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. Hello, I'm film historian Tony Maeda.
And I'm Brad Shreve, who's just a guy who likes movies.
We discuss movies and television from Hollywood's golden age. We go behind the scenes and share our opinions, too.
And of course, being the average guy, my opinions are the ones that matter.
As does your self-delusion. Welcome to Going Hollywood.
I'm Brad.
I'm Tony Maeda.
And
what's your last name, Brad? Brad Shreve. Say your last name.
All right. I am Brad Shreve. Or as all my social media titles say, is I am the Brad Shreve.
You're the Brad Shreve.
Yeah,
I had one
that was Brad Shreve and I accidentally deleted it. And since I couldn't get it back, I changed all of mine to the Brad Shreve, which
that's like with my website, which by the way, we need to mention our social media accounts at the end of these episodes. It's like my website and I can't be that I'm tony-maeda.com, not tonymaeda.com, because my cousin has tonymaeda.com and he's a graphic artist and he won't let it go. So.
And my website is bradshreve.com, and you'll find both of those links in the show notes, as well as our social media accounts.
There you go. See, we need to get that out. Get that over with before. We didn't do it last time.
No, we didn't. And follow both of us. We're fascinating.
We are fascinating. Not as fascinating. Well, no. Just as fascinating as Scotty Bowers, which, how about that lead in?
That was beautiful.
Was that good?
Yes, we are going to talk about Scotty Bowers. What's the name of the film, Tony?
The film is called Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood. It is based on Scotty Bowers' book, Full Service. Now, we're not going to talk about the book, Full Service, because this is a classic Hollywood podcast. However, I heartily recommend you read or listen, because it's on Audible, and which is my favorite way to read, is to listen. It's on Audible. You know, and for those of you who aren't familiar with Scotty Bowers is the, I would say just within the past, 2012 the book came out. So in the past 15 years or 12 years, however many years, you know, finally came out as the legendary urban mythic Hollywood. He wasn't really a pimp. Because he didn't take money, but he was the what would you call it? The arranger of all these assignations.
He says he didn't take money.
He says he didn't take money. But anyway, yes, he was kind of a legend. He was an urban myth for many years. People would say, you have to, you know, this guy who ran this, basically this bordello out of a gas station in Hollywood Boulevard. 5777 Hollywood Boulevard. Well, there's a fire station now. But yeah, this is about Scotty Bowers, who is quite a character, quite a character. Did you know anything about Scotty Bowers before this?
I knew nothing about Scotty Bowers until you said we should watch this film and we should talk about it. Mm-hmm. So first of all, thank you very much. It's absolutely fascinating. I do want to tell, before we begin, we're going to talk dirt about a lot of celebrities here.
Yeah.
And because it's what Scotty had in his book and it's what's in this movie, a lot of this can't be validated. So I want to make sure people know we are not a gossip show, but this book has been sold. It was made a fortune selling.
It was a New York Times bestseller.
New York Times bestseller. The documentary is a classic.
The documentary, Ryan Murphy bastardized it and made a horrible TV show out of it called Hollywood. Don't watch it.
Yeah. So,
it's terrible.
So we're not telling anything that isn't out there already. We're going to talk about this film.
Exactly. Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood.
And whether it's true or not, it's probably going to be part of our conversation. So
yeah.
And we're going to actually, let's get that out.
Well,
no, I don't want to get that out. What I want to ask you before we begin, because what in this movie does, Scotty talk, he basically outs a lot of celebrities who, and those, they were out as either being gay or bisexual,
right,
or many people who were straight, he outs them as being very promiscuous and kinky.
Very libidinous.
And kinky. So my question to you, Tony, is because this has been the biggest debate that I've seen about this book and the film.
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay to out someone after they're dead?
There's that question. I knew you were going to ask me that question. No, I don't think it is. However, and that's a big however, but this was common knowledge, and that's Scotty's line of defense when people say that to him, is this was common knowledge in Hollywood. It just wasn't common knowledge in Omaha. It just wasn't common knowledge in Peoria. You know, I don't mean to pick on the Midwest, but you get what I'm saying. So Scotty's, when Scotty would say that to him, that was always his defense, was, you know, people in Hollywood knew it. He's just putting it in print. So it's a very slippery slope.
Well, and there's actually a scene in the film where
someone, confronts him.
Yeah, Scotty is doing a book signing, and this guy walks up and he says,
at Just Fabulous, one of my favorite stores in Palm Springs.
I've never been there.
He's confronted by someone who says, do you think this is wrong? And that's what he says. It was a open secret.
Yeah, he says, no,
in Hollywood.
He said, it may be news to those squares in Illinois. That's
yeah.
But everybody knew this in Hollywood, so I'm not telling anything anybody didn't know.
And here's the thing. You know what this did for me personally? And I had my own little, not a dark moment of the soul, but I had to reflect on this. Because my first reaction was, you have no right to do that. And I thought, okay, but what's so bad about what he's doing? You know what I mean? I had to confront my own internalized homophobia that I have and say, he's telling the truth about these people, that he's telling his experience with these people. He's every right to do that. And why is that bad? He even says that to that one guy who comes up with, you know, the book and says, how can you do this? He's like, so you're saying it's bad to be gay? It's bad to, these people are living their lives. We are so conditioned by Hollywood, mostly, at least I'm speaking myself pretty much, to this idea that of what's wrong and what's right and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. These people are living their truths. And I had to really look at that and say, so what's bad about this? If he was saying they liked chocolate ice cream, if he was saying they liked pistachio instead of strawberry, would I be like, oh my God, you can't tell somebody, he's dead, he can't defend himself because he likes pistachio? I mean, that's a stupid analogy, but you see what I'm saying? It's because of the shame that we put on it, that it becomes like, how can you do that?
Well, I'm going to tell you what I equate it to is Teddy Roosevelt, who,
that's interesting,
who much of his presidency was in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And he never
Franklin.
I'm sorry, Franklin. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, much later. Franklin Roosevelt was in a wheelchair through much of his presidency, if not all of it, mm-hmm, I'm not sure. And he never allowed the public to see that.
Mm-hmm.
So they now want statues of him in his wheelchair, and many individuals that are in wheelchairs or handicapped in general are praising this. Like, we need,
it's a great idea,
a role model.
It's great.
And others are saying no, because that he did not want people to see that during his lifetime. Shouldn't we honor that after his death?
To me,
it's a valid argument.
It's remarkable. It just goes to show you that. That drives me crazy that people would be against that. It's showing you how much you can accomplish when you have these challenges. You know,
it also shows we've come a long way, baby.
We have come a long way. You know, a lot further to go. But I'm not equating being gay or being bisexual with any kind of a physical handicap. I hate that word.
I
apologize for that.
And I think you understand that's not what I'm doing either.
But it is a challenge, especially in those times. And somebody brings up a very valid point in the film. I think it's probably William Mann or some of the interviewees that you don't understand these people, these kids, I always call them kids, who came of age maybe in the 90s and 2000s, that in the 60s and the 50s, okay, you could be arrested, but you could also be put into an asylum. You could get a lobotomy. I mean, these things happen to people simply because they were hanging out in an all-male club. So what you're doing on Sunday fun day on Robertson Boulevard, 30-plus years ago, well, maybe 40-plus years ago, could have gotten you thrown in Bellevue, could have gotten you thrown in jail, could have gotten your entire life destroyed for one afternoon in a bar or a club. Or even not even then, if you were hanging out at the beach or you were, people would be stopped. People, Scotty talks about it being stopped on his way home from a party. It was an all-male party, minding his own business. Okay, you're coming from a party. Can you imagine driving down Rodeo Drive, 3 a.m. from a fabulous party in the hills, and you get pulled over by a policeman and you're asked, what party were you at? Was it an all-male party? I mean, and he could have been thrown in jail. Now, and Scotty, of course, it turns it into a sexual experience, but that's Scotty Bowers. That's one of the reasons I love Scotty Bowers. But this happened. So people don't realize that. People don't realize how incredibly frightening it was for these people to be their authentic selves. We take it so for granted these days.
Yeah, and going back to the Roosevelt analogy, I mean, being a gay man, I obviously don't think I have a handicap, though. I did it one time in my life.
Sure.
Now I embrace that. I couldn't imagine not being gay. But what I was equating it to is somebody choosing to keep something a secret in their lifetime, and should we do that? But let's talk about today. I mean,
yeah.
You're an actor. You're much more in the industry than I am. I've been to enough parties where actors and actresses who I didn't know were gay, and they aren't out publicly.
Yeah.
So we see this. Like, I'm going to use Kevin Spacey. Mm-hmm. I mean, good God, everybody in Hollywood knew about Kevin Spacey before Kevin Spacey.
Right, but they didn't in Peoria, and that's Scotty's
exactly.
Point.
But that's what I'm saying. Is that okay? I mean, I knew Kevin Spacey because I knew people that he was tossed out of the spa because he kept hitting on the guys.
Yeah. I don't think it's weird because it's a slippery slope, as I said, if the person's dead or alive. Is that really a criteria for it? I don't know. I think it's Kevin Spacey's truth to be told by Kevin Spacey until, you statutory rape somebody and then.
Oh, I agree.
Everybody knows about
it. I agree. But before it was out, I would never consider saying anything.
Yes. I'm thinking more along the lines of as an actor, and we touched on this a bit when I was on Queer We Are. About how it affects your career. That's right. The problem. So if you out an actor and it affects their ability to make a living because suddenly they're not going to be, but that whole mental thing about why can't a gay actor play a straight part and vice versa and all that bullshit, we got to get over that. We've got to get over it and we're getting better at it, but it's still. And so these actors that Scotty was helping, these stars that Scotty was helping, his theory is, and his defense is that he was helping them to live their authentic lives. He was making them happy.
Yeah.
So he doesn't see anything wrong with, they're all dead. And they don't care. And with their families, or what are their families going to say? That's what people always say. You know what? It's 2000. Well, this was 2012. It's 2012. If their families, get over it.
Yeah.
Gay people exist.
Yeah, they did.
They didn't just pop up after Stonewall. They've been around forever.
And to set this up for folks, Scotty was born in 1923-ish.
Ooh, good for you.
He was a Marine in World War II. People kind of use the term hero loosely, but he served in 3 major battles, including one of Iwo Jima. So I'm going to say he was a hero.
Yeah, I think so. I think anybody who serves as a hero, as far as,
Certainly.
Absolutely.
And now after the war.
And his brother was killed.
His brother was killed, which was very tragic to Scotty. is one of the few times I've seen him actually get emotionally in a sad way. Mm-hmm. After the war, he, instead of going home to Illinois, he went to Los Angeles. And as he said, that's what many of the men did after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1946, he started working at the Richfield gas station in Hollywood Boulevard, on Hollywood Boulevard, as a gas station attendant.
Hollywood and Van Ness, for anybody's in the area. Hollywood and Van Ness, there's now a...
big, beautiful fire station.
Big,
there.
Beautiful fire station.
And for those of you not familiar with Hollywood, just to give you a perspective, it's a half a mile from Hollywood and Vine, and about 1.5 miles from Grauman's Chinese Theater, and about the same distance from Paramount. So right there in the midst of Hollywood.
Hard Hollywood.
Is where this gas station is.
Yeah.
And I looked those up specifically so I can give people perspective of where this place was.
This is interesting because you and I have talked about the changing face of Hollywood. Just think about the Hollywood of today. Can you imagine a star the caliber of a Cary Grant driving into a gas station on Hollywood Boulevard today? I mean, just think about that. These stars were in Hollywood. I mean, it's like Cary Grant's driving, George Cukor's driving up to a gas station in shit Hollywood. Yeah. I mean, but that's how much different.
Yeah, there.
So that's amazing.
Hollywood today is a, what is it? What's it? It's not a
cesspool.
Well, no, I'm talking about the when people talk about Hollywood, it's more of a.
Oh yeah, it's a state of mind.
State of mind, because the city of Hollywood, yeah. Or actually, it's not a city. It's never been a city. It's maybe back, I think, in very, very like the early 1900s, it may have been a city, but it's been L.A. ever since. It's a neighbor. It's a community. And
LA absorbed it.
It used to, have luxury hotels. I mean, if you remember Lucy and Ricky in the 50s, that they stayed in Hollywood when they went to Hollywood and had that beautiful apartment that, like everything in just, Hollywood in the movies is just like Paris and all the movies.
Yes.
Everything in Paris overlooks the Eiffel Tower. Well, of course, everything in Hollywood overlooks the Hollywood sign, at least in the movies and TV. And, it's not that way anymore. It's a cesspool. I mean, you walk down the street, if you walk down the Avenue of the Stars, you see drug deals going on. You see tourists all looking at the stars, and they're excited to see those. But they also see them looking around like, what the?
Yeah, we've talked about how depressing.
Yeah, it's pretty depressing. And Mickey Rooney, who we talked about in the Breakfast at Tiffany's, and I'm not a huge fan of Mickey Rooney, for years he did worked very hard to try to restore Hollywood to what it once was. He didn't succeed, as we know.
He didn't.
But that was a big mission of his.
I keep thinking that it's probably, and this might be a bad thing, it might go to the way of, it is probably going to go the way of 42nd Street, and it becomes a Disneyland, which I don't know, good or bad.
Yeah. And
if that's it, it ain't happened yet. I'll tell you right now, it ain't happened yet. But
and everybody's heard about Hollywood and Vine. You're all familiar with that from probably since the beginning of time that was Hollywood. There's also Hollywood and Highland, which is where the Dolby Theater, which is where the Academy, is it the Dolby now? Who bought it?
Mm-hmm. You're right.
It was originally Dolby, wasn't it?
It was originally the Kodak.
Okay, it was the Kodak Theater. Now it's the Dolby Theater, and it's where Grauman's Chinese Theater is as well.
Yeah.
They are a mile apart from each other.
Yeah.
And so there's a nice development now in Hollywood and Highland, and there's a nice new development now at Hollywood and Vine. And the goal was that good development would grow between the two. And we're talking about good development. We're talking about Times Square, all the major chains, Planet Hollywood and all those others, all the usual chains that you see in all the tourist spots and all the usual things. But at least, at least it would be better. Right now, it's all pawn shops between the two.
Yeah.
So it hasn't happened yet.
Hasn't. But the gas station was a mile away from Hollywood and Vine about?
It was a half a mile from Hollywood and Vine.
Yeah. And so he's working at this gas station and movie stars, the very first one, Walter Pigeon, who, for people who don't know who Walter Pigeon was, he was in Mrs. Miniver, and they probably won't know what Mrs. Miniver is. Walter Pigeon was a leading man, I think it's safe to say, in the 30s and 40s. He transitioned into a character actor. For our gay friends out there, he played Florence Ziegfeld in the film A Funny Girl. So if you don't know who Walter Pigeon is, that's Walter Pigeon. And Walter Pigeon was a major star in the 40s. I mean, Mrs. Miniver was a huge film. So he drives in his convertible and meets this good-looking gas station attendant just out of the war and invites him to his house to go for a swim, because that's what you do when you're a movie star getting gas in Hollywood. You invite the gas station attendant to come on up to the hill and it's such a hot day. Let's take a swim. So, of course, Scotty, being the industrious person he was, got in the car and went and took a swim and then some. And that's how it all started.
Tony, I'm stopping our conversation real quick.
Why? Brett, we're in the middle of a podcast.
But this is about the podcast, and it's very important.
Okay.
Listener, whatever app you're listening on, whether it's on the computer or on the phone, reach your finger or your mouse over. It usually says follow. Some still say subscribe. And click that. And what's going to happen when they do that, Tony?
They're going to get notified when a new episode is available, and they can listen to us again. You know, you don't want to miss that.
No.
Can we get back to the episode that we were recording?
Of course.
Please?
Of course.
All right. Thank you. Don't forget to subscribe and follow.
There you go. We haven't talked about profanity here. How far do we want to go?
Well, I've already dropped the F-bomb, haven't I?
Okay, good. I just want to make sure, because I have no problem with that.
Well, yeah. Well, Scotty also.
Okay, because Scotty uses fuck a lot, so.
He also did it a lot, too.
And he talks about giving blowjobs a lot, so.
So he got like.
So anyway, go back to where you were.
So that's how it started, and he got about $20. And it soon became a cottage industry, this gas station. He got all of his buddies who were, when he realized what a lucrative opportunity this was, he got his buddies who recently out of the Army, out of the Marines, who didn't have jobs. You know, they served their country and they have no money. And it became a small cottage industry out of this gas station in the middle of Hollywood, where he would set these trysts up. And what's a little cottage industry?
And what Scotty says in the film is he told these guys, they were all good looking guys, and he's like, and I guess at least a good percentage of them were straight, according to him. He's like, it's 20. He said everything was $20, no matter what. It's always $20. He's like,
no matter what it was.
He's like, they just want to give you a blowjob. He's like, shut your eyes, pretend it's your girlfriend, and you get $20 for a blowjob. And that's kind of how it started into this whole.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. And he made connection. I mean, his connections just grew and grew and grew. And he eventually ended up, you know, people, obviously Walter Pidgeon talked because the next thing you know, George Cukor was driving in and Cary Grant was driving in. I mean, so it's pretty astounding. I mean, the thing about Scotty's story and the thing that I think my first reaction was, is this real? Is this true? Could this really have happened? You know, because our idea of what Hollywood was and what it really was are so different. And, you know, after you watch this film, or if you read Scotty's book, Full Service, or you watch this film, which we're talking about today, I believe him. The man does not have doesn't seem to have a deceitful bone in his body except to himself. The only person he deceives is himself.
Oh, yeah.
About things, which we can go into later about his past. But I can't see a reason why he would make such a bold faced statement if it weren't true.
I will say I believe most of it is true, especially since there were so many people involved in this. There were other guys hustling with him or doing sex work with him.
And they're in the film.
Sorry for those that get offended by the term hustler.
They're in the film, and they corroborate what he says.
And if this was a lot of lies, even though the celebrities are dead, some people would have came forward and said, this is bullshit. Mm-hmm. And I have seen a couple of small articles, but not anything substantial. I will say and we'll get into it. Most of it, I believe, towards the end, he started really getting into more stories. Well, I'll say it. Like he talked about when he was a young boy.
Yeah.
That he was hooking up his lesbian teacher
at the age of 11.
You know, and there were other things like that. I'm like, okay, you know, this is starting to get past believability here. Because he pretty much made it sound like everybody was fucking everybody. And it is Hollywood, and Hollywood's known for its pretty crazy days. And he talks about how it used to be very conservative, and it was. But he does stretch it a bit to me. I don't know if I believe all of it. I do believe most of it. I do believe most of it. And
yeah, I know the 11-year-old pimping out his, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, come on. Especially his age. Well, if he was, he was probably around 10-ish, he said. So we're talking about in the mid-30s.
He said he was 11, 12.
Okay, so it would have been the mid-30s. And he has a teacher who he happens to know is a lesbian, and he's pimping people out to her. I don't know. That kind of stretches it, especially because he was a small town.
But if you notice, he also says when Matt, the filmmaker, asks him, how old were you? And he goes, I was 11. Because he was talking about the girl he was hooking up with at 11. And then it's revealed that, well, he's been sexually active. He was basically groomed by a neighbor when he was 6 or 7 years old. And the thing about Scotty is that he doesn't see anything wrong with that. He doesn't, it doesn't occur to him. He keeps saying, I wanted it. I wanted it to happen. And it's like, but you're at 6 and 7. You don't even know. I mean, that's just, it doesn't occur to him.
Yeah.
And is that denial? Is that, you know, is he just saying, is that, that's trauma. He doesn't realize it, but are we judging that? I mean, I don't know. It's a very strange thing. His reaction to the fact that he was molested and sexually assaulted so young.
I watched this with my husband, Maurice, and when he was talking about being molested at, or what we consider being molested at that age, and that, you know, it's no big deal. I don't know why people make a big deal. He and I were just cringing. Like,
yeah, it is kind of cringy. Yeah.
First of all, it doesn't make our community look very good. Second of all, it is creepy.
It's very creepy. It's very cringy. It's very wrong. But if you notice, it was married men and priests who were molesting him. I do not take that on our quote unquote community. I take that on, you know, homophobia. The first guy he talks about in the film who molested him was his neighbor who was married and had kids that he played with. And then the second guy was a priest and he serviced a lot of priests in Chicago. So it's just like, okay, well, there you go, Catholic Church. Well done again.
Yeah. And I'm going to say my theory on priests. If you're devout Catholic and you're told that being gay is a sin and you shouldn't act upon it, you become a priest. Yeah, because
true.
Then you don't have to act out sexually.
Yeah, that's it, exactly.
You try not to. Obviously, but not many have succeeded at that.
We know what happens. So anyway, that's all within saying that he's very, if he's in denial about anything, he's in denial about what that might have done to his psyche. But it also enabled him to do what he did later in his life with such ease and non-judgment. You know, he's the most non-judgmental person, you know, I've ever seen.
And well, that is for sure. I mean, and I love it when somebody, he said, you know, people ask, you know, what, because he's married to a woman during this film and he was married before and he talks about all the sex with men. And he said, you know, people ask me what I am. I'm everything. Or does he say I'm nothing? Either one. Yeah, I think he says I'm everything.
I think he says I'm everything.
I'm everything. Yeah.
What's interesting about the film, as opposed to the book, is the film is his life after the book came out. And his wife plays a big part in the film. And she didn't know anything about this when they got married. Can you imagine? And she says, at one point she says, if I had known about this, maybe I wouldn't have gotten married. And she looks right at him, you know. And it's so, there's a great deal of pain with her.
And I agree with you. I mean, she seems pained throughout this whole thing. I mean, she does not seem happy. Yes. But my feeling is, even whether she cared or not, he didn't give her the opportunity to decide whether.
Exactly.
And that's where she seemed most concerned.
He comes out with this major bestseller. Plus, he's a hoarder. Yeah. Plus, they can't even move. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I was listening to somebody was talking about the film, and they said that, you know, it's kind of like Grey Gardens, which of course my back went up. I was like, what are you saying about Grey Gardens? Don't tell me about Grey Gardens. Yeah, but he's kind of living like Grey Gardens in the fact that he's hoarding. I mean, you can't even move in his, he has like three houses, you know, in storage spaces.
And that he inherited different things. And
so this guy clearly has some mental challenges.
Oh, big time.
You know, it's like an episode of Hoarders, some of those visits. He goes to his storage units and he's like, oh, you never know where you're going to use this. And he's picking up toilets on the side of the street. I'm like, you don't need, you have a New York Times bestseller. Why are you getting a toilet off the street?
He's picking up toilets on the side of the street and he says, in case I need one. I'm like, when the fuck do you need a toilet? You're going to keep a toilet lying around in case you need one someday?
It's like Hoarder's textbook 101, you know, in case I need it. You never know when you might need this.
And the other thing,
so yeah,
his wife keeps talking about how run down the house has gotten and keep pointing out this rotten porch they're on. And Scotty just sold this bestseller. He does have a lot of money. He's inherited money from different people he knew. You wouldn't know it from what he lives in. Of course, I don't know how well he spent it. But even down to they had problems on the roof. He's 90-something. He's 91, I think, when this film was made.
Yeah, well, he's 88 when the book came out.
Okay, so I think he was 91. Something 90, we'll say.
He has his 90th birthday party.
Yeah, he has his 90th birthday party.
In the very beginning, yes.
And he's climbing. He's talking about how much in pain he is, and he's climbing up this ladder to the roof to do work up on the roof, and he's trimming his own palm trees. When I had my house at 35 years old, I didn't trim my own palm trees, for God's sakes. I hired a guy to climb up there.
You know what, though?
But he's so cheap, he won't do it. He keeps saying that.
That might not be cheapness. That might also be denial of age, because my father would climb ladders at 89 and 90. And my mother would say, get down from that ladder. And he wouldn't do it because he was, damn it, he's going to do it. He could still do it. And Scotty says that I can still do this. So that's also, I think that might also be a denial of age.
Well, the other thing he says is, I know I can do better than they do, which really fit his personality.
Yes.
That really fit his personality that you saw throughout the film.
Yes. Oh, of course. Yes. Well, he's total control freak.
So to give you folks an idea of his operation, in case you haven't seen the film or read the book, this wasn't just a guy standing there in a gas station, you know, pointing people in directions. In the back of the gas station, there was a trailer. And that trailer was divided by curtains into two separate rooms with king-size beds. So he would rent people out to go there and have sex. He put a, not necessarily a glory hole, it didn't sound like, but more of a peephole in the bathroom.
Peephole.
Where you could pay.
For people who like to watch.
Sit on the toilet and watch. And not just watch guys peeing, but also watch guys that were in the bathroom having sex at the same time. Mm-hmm.
He had a friend, what did he say, an old queen who had a hotel across the street.
He said, my friend was an old queen who had a hotel across the street. And would say, okay, I've got this room, this room, this room, $5, you know, whenever somebody wants to come use it. So this was a major operation.
And he would go to people's homes.
And he would go to people's homes.
Not just the homes, the hotels. I mean, he talks about going to the Beverly Hills Hotel, to the bungalows, because you can get to the bungalows right off the street, which is still true today.
Yes, and they would do parties. And
you know, he would go to people's homes. He was became the thing that I find really fascinating about this, the sex aside, is how close he became to these people. I mean, he became close, not only did he not only trick, quote unquote, with George Cukor, they became friends. They became friends to the point where he became close with Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. I mean, who were close to Cukor. Spencer Tracy lived on Cukor's estate in a guest house. He didn't live with Hepburn. That's a myth. They did not live together there. That was his. Hepburn would visit. But he would, you know, and there's also stories about him, and you and I touched on this a bit the last time I was on Queer We Are about Hepburn and Tracy's relationship and was it real, wasn't it real? And, you know, he says quite frankly that Hepburn was a lesbian. You know, she never would have thought of herself as a lesbian, but he says, you know, he set her up with women, a lot of women, throughout their career.
And that's something I want to bring up because you did bring that up. My other podcast is Queer We Are, and that's how Tony and I met. And you described the situation because I love Katharine Hepburn, and you said, and I brought up the fact that, you know, over the, what the story has always been that you hear is that either she was married or he was married, and that's why they never got together, even though they loved each other for so many years. And I may be wrong. I think you said maybe there probably was love in the beginning, but it turned into more of a friendship over time.
Yes. Yes.
And that's kind of what Scotty says, except Scotty goes on to describe that Spencer Tracy was, if nothing else, bisexual. Mm-hmm. Sounds more like he was homosexual, the way Scotty kind of hinted at. Mm. And Katharine Hepburn was lesbian. And I'm like, okay, I don't know. That Tony didn't talk about that part.
No. Well, I think what I did talk about when we did Queer We Are is that you can't take our 21st century ideals of what sexuality is and impose them on early to mid 20th century. It just isn't that, you know, no one was gay. You can't do gay, straight. He talks about the spectrum of sexuality. Mm-hmm. Hepburn never would have considered herself a lesbian because the term lesbian would not have ever occurred to her because she had affairs with men. She had a long affair with Howard Hughes. She was married briefly. She was in love with Spencer Tracy when they first met. When they first met on Woman of the Year, you know, as I said to you in Queer We Are, all you have to do is watch Woman of the Year. The chemistry is undeniable. I mean, they see each other and it's like a bomb goes off. I mean, you see it in their eyes. So there was definitely a physical at the very beginning that probably because she was, you know, bisexual or she liked women and developed into a romantic friendship. Regardless of the fact they were there for each other. It doesn't matter if they were sleeping together or not in the end. It was not this great, long, decades-long romantic relationship, though, that Hepburn herself perpetuated after he died. That's all on her. So it makes perfect sense to me that she still sought solace in women because she needed that kind of... He didn't give that to her. He didn't give her what she needed. She needed something, obviously, from women that a close relationship with a woman can provide. And here's the thing I think is interesting about Tracy, is that everyone always says, well, you know, no one could understand why he drank. Why was he drinking? You know, she questions, why is he drinking? Why is he drinking? He's, you know, he's the biggest, he's the actor's actor. No one was more respected in Hollywood by his peers than Spencer Tracy was. Why is this man so tortured? Well, it makes perfect sense to me that if you're Catholic and you're married and you find you have attraction to men and everyone is telling you that's wrong and you're going to burn in hell, of course you're a little tortured. So that actually makes a lot of sense to me. That I don't think that Tracy was homosexual. I think probably had homosexual tendencies and was afraid of this attraction he had, which made him drink and made him ornery and made him, because he also had affairs with women in addition to Hepburn. So it's really fascinating, but I think that's one of the reasons why I went, oh, I think there might be some truth to this story, because that makes perfect sense to me about Tracy.
Well, as an alcoholic, I'm thinking, well, people become alcoholics for reasons that there don't always have to be a reason.
No, it's a disease. I agree with you
on that. But he doesn't sound like he was an alcoholic. Yeah, that is not for me to judge. But it sounds more like he had a drinking problem, which is different.
Well, he would go on binges. He would disappear. Yeah. He would go on binges. He was, you know, when Scotty talks about in the movie that he would, you know, that's when he would have sex. I heard someone refer to him as a blow and go guy. I guess that's what the kids are calling it now. One of these guys that said, Christ, you know, and they'd say it in the boys in the band, Christ, I was so drunk last night. I don't remember what happened. And that was Tracy's MO with Scotty, was he would invite, you know, Scotty would come over just to spend time with him and they would drink, or Tracy would drink. And then he would say, you know, don't go, hang out with me. And then of course, one thing led to another. And then the next morning, nobody remembered anything. Well, Scotty remembered it and he wrote it down clearly in this book.
You were talking about his friendships with these folks. And I got to say, this is one of the things that kind of stretches my believability. What he said is, if he was just pimping out and having sex, it would be one thing. But the fact that he pretty much puts himself as really hanging out and having these great friendships with all these people, it seems to me like it would have come out a little more than it did.
Oh, you mean, what do you mean? People would know about it?
It wouldn't be such a big secret. Yeah, more people would know about it. It wouldn't be such a hidden secret.
Well, I think people did know about it. I think he was an urban legend for many, many years. I remember hearing about him before I met him. I went to Tony Sharmaley, who is the director whose house he goes to, who has the Emmys, when he points out the Emmys. Tony Sharmaley was a director, a choreographer, award-winning, worked with Mitzi Gaynor and Debbie Reynolds. And Tony Sharmaley would have these parties, and Scotty was a good friend of Tony Sharmaley's. And I can remember being at a party, a 4th of July party, and I didn't know who Scotty was, but he was there. And, you know, there was this urban legend about this guy who was basically, they called him the pimp to the stars, but he claims he wasn't a pimp. So it was out there, but just like the stories of these, it just wasn't out there in Peoria. It just wasn't out there in Chicago. It was known in Hollywood. So he's kind of like an urban myth, an urban legend that came to life when he wrote this book. People had been urging him to write this book, but he didn't, you know, for whatever reason, normal reasons, he was hesitant because he didn't want people to say exactly what they said, like, how can you do this? So yeah, he was around. What I think is interesting though, and this is the thing too, because my thought too was when he's talking about this friendships with these people, with Cecil Beaton of all people, Cecil Beaton and Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. But if you think about it for a minute, if you see a way to get an itch scratched, which you're just dying to get this itch scratched, and somebody's offering you a way which is easy and reliable and is not going to cause a fuss, you're going to go to that. So naturally he was embraced because they knew, they trusted him, and they knew they could get their needs satisfied very easily with this man. So of course they're going to embrace him. You know, it kind of makes sense when you really think about it.
And you do touch on one thing that they do bring up a lot. And I will say the people that, I don't want to say worked for him, the other guys that he hooked up with other celebrities that are still alive. There were some of the guys that he was pimping out, whether you want to use that term or not, that he never would have said anything. And that's why he had these people's trust. And he said, when he was confronted, like, why are you, you're selling this book? And he said,
right,
if any of these people were alive, I wouldn't take a dime for it. And it seemed like people really believed, the people that were around him were like, Scotty never talked.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know that he could have gotten these people to corroborate his stories. You know what I mean? On film. You know, those two gentlemen, the guy, it's so funny, the one who talked about Paul Lynn.
Yes.
You know, being, you know, how mean he was, which I've always heard about Paul Lynn. That's another thing that's...
Paul Lynn had a drinking problem, so...
Yeah, definitely.
He would get nasty, yeah.
He was a mean... But he was also a closeted gay man.
Paul Lynn was gay?
That closet was like, you know, the sports arena. It was so big. No, I think that... Another thing that makes that to me lends credibility to Scotty's story is that he also brings up people like Paul Lynn, like Charles Laughton, who we know were gay, who was documented. Mm-hmm. It's not just Scotty. So he peppers the bombshells of a Tracy and Hepburn with a Cole Porter, with a Charles Laughton, you know, with people that we know were gay, and I think that's, or a Rock Hudson, God knows. You know, we're at this point right now where we forget what a bombshell it was that Rock Hudson was gay to most of the world.
Yeah.
When he died. But I remember that. And I remember that people were shocked, you know, but they weren't in Hollywood. They knew it, you know?
Well, yeah, it was so well known in Hollywood. There have been rumors that Rock Hudson and, Jim Nabors.
Yeah, remember that.
Were married. And the reason why that rumor exists was back late 60s, early 70s, way before Rock Hudson was outed by Armistead Maupin. The reason that rumor existed, there were these guys that had parties every year, and they always made up what the party was. There was like, this is a party to celebrate such and such.
Mm-hmm.
And one year they said it was because Rock Hudson and Jim Nabors it was to celebrate their marriage.
Right.
And it's because it was that well known. Everybody knew that both of those men were gay.
Yeah.
So, you're right. None of this was a secret.
Yeah, and he peppers in there, you know, the Cary Grant and Randolph Scott thing, which you and I briefly discussed.
You mean the swinging bachelors and their pads?
The swinging bachelor pads, you know, which were clearly like, they were publicity photos, so they were no proof. You know, it wasn't in at all. But, yeah, Cary Grant, when we talked about this, Cary Grant lived with Ori Kelly, who is a very famous costume designer, when he was Archie Leach in New York, you know, and Ori Kelly talks about it in his book. You know, it's just people live long lives and have lots of experiences. And, you know, it's just, it's really kind of naive of us to buy the bait that Hollywood throws us about these people's lives. They were artists. Artists are crazy. You know, they're normal people, but they're crazy. They have appetites. It's crazy to think they're living in, you know, these little suburban scenarios. And I think Scotty kind of blew the lid off that.
And one thing he brought up that did seem very real to me is he did bring up that Cary Grant and Ori Kelly were a couple, and that he dropped Ori like a rock when he met Randolph Scott because of the reason that Ori Kelly was known to be gay. He was flamboyant, and it was no secret.
Right.
And to protect himself, and probably because he was attracted to Randolph Scott, the guy was pretty hot.
Well, yeah, I think Scotty gets his time. Cary Grant broke up with Ori Kelly long before he met Randolph Scott. So, I mean, Cary Grant, that ended because, as I said to you in Queer We Are, you know, Cary Grant's aim, primarily objective in life, was Cary Grant. Mm-hmm. And when he came to Hollywood, he realized, you know, with the production code coming into force and the conservative attitude really clamping down on him, that he needed to be with a woman. So he married Virginia Cherryl. His first wife was Virginia Cherryl, who was in Charlie Chaplin's City Lights. So that was, the Ori Kelly thing was long over before he met Randolph Scott. But his point is accurate.
Okay. Well, he was 90. We can forgive him.
Yeah. I mean, his point's accurate, though. It's true. It's true that he... You know, Cary Grant was probably like, I'm Cary Grant. I'm not going to be with this guy. You know, it's accurate in its, what did we just say that I said I hated? It's truthful. It's not necessarily accurate, but it's truthful, you know?
Yeah.
Which, you know, this is, we were just talking about the terrible version of this book that Ryan Murphy put out called Hollywood, which really bothered me because it totally took Scotty out of the equation, which made me so sad because Scotty's life is so amazing, clearly by this movie that we're talking about and by his book. Why, you know, why would you take him out of the equation? But he did.
And I want to get into some of the more people that he claims that he hooked up or had sex with. But to give people an idea how much, and for lack of a better term, respect Scotty had, or how much people, I don't know if it was publishing party for his book or whatever. The movie opens up and he's at Chateau Marmont with this huge crowd of people on an event they held for him. It was his birthday, actually.
It was his birthday.
On this patio. And to give you an idea, Chateau Marmont, if you can stay there for $600 a night, you're getting a deal.
Yeah. That's something.
This is no slouch of a hotel. So that cost a pretty penny.
It did cost a pretty penny. And there was a lot of people. A lot of old Hollywood there, not necessarily names that you would recognize immediately, but I mean, I saw Carol Cook there. I saw a couple people there that I recognized. So, I mean,
I saw a lot of plastic surgery.
Well, that was, it was kind of the theme when they would have these parties. How about the cocktail party that he was working? He was the cocktail host for, where he was working in the party that was later. And you saw a lot of that too. It's a fact of Hollywood, you know, unfortunately. Nobody wants to grow older. That's just the way it is. But he's pretty remarkable at 90, 92, when this film was made. I really admire how brave he was, and just in his personal life, not necessarily, and his non-judgment. Yes, I think there's problems there with what he had in his past and his, but it's his life. You know what? It's his life. He gets to write the story. We don't.
Yeah. And I already mentioned he made me sad in many ways. And we can even get more into that. We've kind of mentioned him and we can get more into him. But he is. It's just like no judgment in this guy.
None.
None. It's beautiful.
What a great thing, right? If we could all live that way, it might have been caused by trauma. But the result was that he, at least in his take, he helped a lot of people out, and he was just non-judgmental about people.
And he's a people pleaser. So
it's a people, total people pleaser.
Yeah, he's a people pleaser. So there could be lots of reasons why somebody's a people pleaser, but he didn't seem like he hurt a fly. So
no, it's kind of remarkable to me too that he survived AIDS. That to me, when AIDS came along in this story, I was like, oh God.
Well, he said he was lucky. I wasn't out during the AIDS crisis. I wasn't celibate. We'll put it that way. But I wasn't out. But I have numerous friends that survived the AIDS crisis. Some of them survived with AIDS, or with HIV. But some didn't catch it all. And like he said, they're lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
They're lucky. Some people just got lucky. He also said that destroyed his business.
Well.
Because it just wasn't safe anymore.
It might have been time to retire, too. I mean, he was...
Yeah.
He was doing other things, but yeah, he was I can't believe he still bartended at 90. I mean, God, my bartending days were way long ago, and I'm not near 90 yet. Not yet.
I find it really interesting that, as we mentioned, that he said he was everything because he was so bisexual, and he does list off Walter Pigeon and Charles Laughton and Spencer Tracy.
Noel Coward.
And he talks about having women hook up with Katharine Hepburn, but he also talks about having sex with other women. Because in addition to saying he had a three-way with Randolph Scott and Rock Hudson, which I initially thought, well, God, did they really have to have three ways with them? They went to these parties. But if you saw the pictures of Scotty when he was in that era, he was no slouch.
No.
So he was pretty hot.
He was, yes.
And gifted.
Yes. Blessed, we would call it.
But he had a three-way with Lana Turner and Ava Gardner.
that was very
that funny. Was
funny. And that ended up in Confidential. See, that's the thing. That ends up – that was an interesting point. I'm glad you brought that up. Confidential Magazine, which was, as he says very astutely, the National Enquirer of its day, whose goal it was to expose people's sexual secrets.
Destroy lives, you know, was their goal.
Destroy lives. Liberace sued them. Tab Hunter had issues with Confidential. Maureen O'Hara sued them. I mean, it's crazy. This magazine was out to destroy lives. And there's that story about the man that the night of passion. Is that what the Confidential thinks that Lana and Ava shared? And it was Scotty. And he refused to sign verify the accuracy of it.
And they would pay him for it because he said they did pay other guys to do it.
They paid other guys to do it. Yeah. And he said no. So you got to admire that. I mean, this man could have, $1,000 in 1958 or whenever that was, 57, 58. You know, it's quite a chunk of change. And
well, it's a chunk of change, but, you know, and easier than doing $20 a pop for
yeah.
sex.
I mean, come on, you know, or bartending or all that stuff he did, but he wouldn't do it. And I, you know, I admire that. I admire that. He was definitely, he had an interesting form of integrity. And well, I think it's pretty remarkable.
Well, others you said he had sex with were Cary Grant, which I find that believable. Mm-hmm. Betty Davis and Vivian Lee.
I believe that. Yeah, the Vivian Lee's very funny.
He said he did have sex with J. Edgar Hoover, which the only reason I would question that is J. Edgar Hoover was so in the closet, I think it would be more secretive. But at the same time, he also admitted that J. Edgar wasn't all that hot of a guy.
Again,
so I did believe that.
Scotty could be trusted. You know, that's right. The whole thing. I mean, you know, George Cukor gave him the seal of approval and he, you know, and he could be trusted. So it makes sense. You know, Tim Gunn talks about in his book, you know, Tim Gunn is right from mm-hmm. Project Runway, about when he was a kid and he lived in Washington, D.C., about his father who worked in government bringing him to some office building in Washington, D.C. on a Saturday to meet Vivian Vance. And he said, you know, and he was a kid and he loved I Love Lucy. And he met Vivian Vance in Washington. And he started to think later on, why was Vivian Vance in Washington, D.C.? And she didn't look like Vivian Vance. And then later on, he put on, oh, it was J. Edgar Hoover. it was actually because his father knew J. Edgar Hoover. And that's who it was. And he was in full drag. So I guess I think that's probably, I don't know. I hope he paid him well.
What year was that?
That would have been in the 50s. The late 50s.
Okay, because I was going to say I've seen early pictures of Vivian Vance, and she was gorgeous, but
yeah, it was 50s or 60s.
Even in 50s, when she was made to give that frumpy look, she looked better than J. Edgar Hoover in a wig, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it was probably early.
Yeah,
early 60s, probably when Tim Gunn was, or maybe late 50s.
Maybe if you squint your eyes.
Well, yeah, and you're a kid, you know. But I mean, you couldn't have fooled me. I would have known it wasn't Vivian Vance. I mean, like, that's not Vivian Vance. Get out of here.
No,
it's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy. I just thought it was interesting. I love the guys that he had on who he could still get a hold of who had worked for him and how indebted they were to him, how much they loved him still.
They did.
That one guy, I mean, they just adored him. And it just makes you question, you know, wow, how could this... What reason would they have if he was not telling the truth? Would they have for doing this? They didn't get any money from this documentary. they weren't making a buck from this.
No, they didn't. And you know, like one guy said, I wasn't that much of a looker. I don't know his exact words, but he didn't think he was that much of an item. And Scotty said he was busy as hell.
Help him get that house. He said he got that house.
Yeah.
So yep. You know, you got to be grateful for that.
Yeah, well, Scotty bought his house. I don't remember how much he paid. Said he paid for it. $22,000, I think, when he bought it. He
just, yes.
Just recently sold, not long after he died, for like $900,000.
And all these places that were left to him. You know, Corbin Burnson's godfather, he lived in that house, the guy Beach he was talking about, who was the kind of the B-movie actor, C-movie actor, who left him mm-hmm. all these properties. He's Corbin Burnson's, from L.A. Law, Corbin Burnson's godfather. Talks about it. And, you know, he loved Scotty. He was in love with Scotty and he left him all these properties when he died. And he still gets, he was still getting residual checks from this
guy.
Yeah,
he's getting residual checks for different actors and
stuff.
So
it's pretty amazing. And
then we talked about Scotty being kind of a sad character. And that's one of the things that really depressed me here. What was the man's name that was Corbin Burnson's?
Beach.
Okay. So when Beach died, mm-hmm. he said Corbin wanted to rent a yacht and bury him at sea.
Yeah.
And Scotty said, that's bullshit. No, we're not going to do that. And so for decades, it sounds like, Beach's ashes were in the trunk of a car in a garage.
In a storage unit, yeah.
In a storage unit. And towards the end of the film, what Scotty did with these ashes was... He opened up the bag and he took the bag out of the box, I think, for the first time.
Yeah.
He cut open the bag and then there was a crack.
A
hole in the patio because it's so old and rotten. He just dumped the ashes through this hole and started hosing it down with a hose. And I'm like,
yeah,
nothing really seemed, he seemed very unemotional. It was, and I'm like, Corbin, granted, maybe he didn't need a burial at sea, but Corbin wanted to bury the man at sea, and you're just flushing him, practically flushing him down the toilet. Not exactly, but
I
found that very sad. He talked about his daughter, that his daughter died from having a botched abortion when it was illegal, which obviously is very tragic. And he said, I was on my way to Malibu, and I just continue what I was doing. I don't get this bullshit. People saying they're sick and don't fulfill their duties.
There's definitely a disconnect there. There's definitely a disassociation, and I'm not a psychiatrist, psychologist. I can't tell you what trauma does to when you have a young life in your life, when you have young and you're young and you have trauma. But I mean, it makes perfect sense to me, you know, that kind of disassociation.
Yeah. And that's, it does. And it's funny because Maurice and I watched it and then we discussed it together and we both had the same feelings because he seemed very unemotional through the whole thing. I'm talking about the ashes. I talked about he said he went to work with when his daughter died because that's what you do. But when he talked about his brother dying in the war, it was the first time he really showed emotion. He was crying. You could tell he was fighting bawling.
Yeah.
That was the first time I saw real emotion there.
Yeah, it was a very moving scene. What is it about? Maybe it was the youth thing. Maybe it was because he was just a kid himself when that happened.
I may have been the youth thing. I think it also would have been that Scotty was very active in the war as well. And his brother was actually in the war shorter than he was. And Scotty survived these big battles.
It could also be the tie with his brother. You know, I'm jaded ex-actor and gay actor in Hollywood. You know, I don't get, you know, the silliest things get me emotional. But I tell you, the one thing that does get me emotional is anytime I talk about my parents. You know, it's that bond, which is so primal from when you're a child. And I think that he might have had that with his brother because of what they went through. I mean, I don't know. I'm, like I said, I'm not a psychologist. I don't understand, you know, what makes him get emotional about that as opposed to his daughter, you know, who he clearly states he wasn't there enough, you know, he keeps everything the same. You notice that her phone was still there.
And not only was her phone still there, you said it was still connected.
Still connected.
In this house that he doesn't even live in anymore.
Doesn't go into. He only goes into wind the clock.
But he has not disconnected that phone.
Clearly, a man with a lot of issues, a lot of issues. Yeah, it's a field day for a psychologist, I think.
Oh my God, yes.
But
yes.
It's also kind of wonderful. The effects of it in the non-judgmental thing is the plus side to it, the good side to it. The bad side is all this other stuff we're talking about.
And it probably helped him with his business. I mean, he was emotionally detached.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's like a doctor. A doctor, I don't know, not a great comparison, but, you know, yeah, doctors absolutely have to be emotionally detached to do what they do, I'm sure. So it served him well in his business. And, you know, in his life, maybe not so much sometimes.
So I want to get your final take on it. We kind of both have talked about where we feel, but here's my gut on the reality of Scotty's story. Like the Ori Kelly and the Cary Grant story, where you said that, you know, he said that Cary dropped Ori to get with Randolph Scott. And you said, no, there were gaps. There was a huge gap there between those years. I think he gets some things confused. Yeah, sure. So I don't believe everything that he said. I believe the vast majority of it's true. I refuse to accept that all of this is made up because it would be exposed very easily. And
so difficult.
Yeah. But I do think a lot of it is embellished. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was just too much I just felt like he made out like that everybody in Hollywood was his friend and everybody in Hollywood was having sex and the whole background with the teacher and all that. I feel like that was all embellished, whether he meant to or not. I don't know what your take is.
No, I see what you're saying. I feel like many things, you know, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. You know, I think that it's very difficult. And I said this to Jerry when we were writing the book, that, you know, memory is a very tricky thing. You know, who among us can remember things that happened to the exact detail when we were 16, when we were 17, unless they were hugely traumatic things. So he's going, he's coming from a perspective of 80 plus years, remembering things that happened
right
50, 60 years before. So I think, yeah, his timeline can be off, but you know, the essence of it, I believe, I think is true. I think maybe he got dates mixed up. You know, it's truth versus accuracy. But I can forgive it when it's somebody's life they're remembering, as opposed to when you're creating a story on somebody's life. So it's his life he's remembering, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and I agree. And there's so many things I've learned. There's very little that people can do that shock me.
Yeah, but I think the positive thing about this is, and what I love about Scotty Bowers' book and this movie, Scotty in the Secret History of Hollywood, is taking away the fact that we're all human beings who have needs, who have desires, who have urges, and how wonderful that there was this kind of like Peter Pan type character who helped these people out in a time when it was not only scary to be your true self, but could get you in jail and could get you killed and could get you in a mental institution. So how wonderful. What a wonderful kind of fairy tale for him. No pun intended.
And back to where I started was whether it's right or not to out people after they're dead. I don't remember who the gentleman was. He was interviewed quite a bit. He was a heavily gentleman. I think he may have been a film critic or something of that nature. He frequently was defending Scotty, saying that these are people that couldn't come out at the time, and Scott's giving, in a sense, giving them the freedom that they didn't have.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, they couldn't enjoy it at the time.
Yeah.
You know, that's just an unfortunate fact of Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, and it's still, we talked about this a bit. It's still happening, man. It's still there today. You know, there's a lot more gay actors in Hollywood than are out gay actors. You know, I mean, for every Neil Patrick Harris and every Russell Tovey, there are dozens who are not out because they know what it could do to their careers. Yeah, still.
You are 100% correct there. That is for sure.
Yeah. Well, this was fun. I like talking about Scotty.
It was fun. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah.
I enjoyed talking about this one. So again, the link for Tony's website and my website and the link to for the show's website, which is part of Tony's, as well as our social media, are all in the show notes. And
go watch this movie. It's on Amazon. Scotty and the Secret History of Hollywood.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. It's very well done.
It's wonderful to watch. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening.